The American Classical Orchestra is devoted to preserving and performing the repertoire of 17th to 19th century composers by playing their works on original period instruments. On Tuesday, November 27th, the orchestra will be joined by the choirs of Trinity Church Princeton and Trinity Church New Haven to perform Bach's Magnificat and other Baroque works at 8 p.m. in Lincoln Center's Alice Tully Hall. And joining us now are Thomas Crawford, founding music director and conductor of the American Classical Orchestra, and Mark Shackman, an oboist in the American Classical Orchestra. We've been listening to his playing. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Tom, you founded the orchestra in 1985. Why was it important to you for the orchestra to perform on period instruments?
Well, because there was a movement in Europe for some years that had, where players had taken interest in the techniques and the instruments themselves, and they rediscovered the playing techniques, and the sound to me was glorious. You know, I just took an instant interest, and I found that we had some advanced players living in the metropolitan area here in New York. So we put them together, and instantly it was the texture that won me over.
And when did that change? At the late 19th century? When the instruments we now play as modern instruments actually became the dominant instruments?
Well, it kind of follows the evolution of each family of instruments. I mean, in the case of the strings, people still play on Strads today in the New York Philharmonic. They were converted. So the use
converted
of,
in what way?
They used to be made of gut, for example, and a period orchestra like ours still uses gut. But then they became made of metal, I guess around the time of the First World War, when wire became universally and inexpensively available like that. And, timpani heads became plastic instead of leather. More and more keys were added to the winds over time to handle both louder and more chromatic repertoire from the Romantic era. But there were profound changes in the character of the instruments themselves. I mean, one might say, well, having more keys on an instrument is an advantage, right? You can play more notes. And that would be true if the instrument sounded the same, but they don't sound the same.
Now, Mark, you play the oboe.
Yes.
Are the instruments you play period instruments or reproductions?
These are copies. In the case of the wind instruments, because of what happens to them in terms of moisture constantly going through the instrument and then drying out, we find that the actual antiques are often in not very good condition. And certainly if you played them with the sort of concert schedule that we all have, they certainly wouldn't last. And so we rely upon very, very careful and exacting people who make these replicas. They measure them. The originals exist in private collections and in museums, and so we play replicas. As Tom said, in the case of the string instruments, they've tried to make a better violin for 250 years, and they haven't succeeded. They haven't succeeded.
The ideal.
And so what we do here is, in a sense, reset up, recondition those old instruments to their appropriate conditions.
Now, did you learn to play the oboe on a period instrument?
No.
I
studied at Juilliard and got involved in this business, although it wasn't a business at that point, in 1973 when I formed a chamber group with a bunch of colleagues from school, the Aulos Ensemble. And at that point, there were no orchestras. This was not something that the movement really in this country had just gotten started, as Tom said. It had a big head start, in a sense, in Europe. And we were some of the first people to do it here.
And what kind of adjustments did you have to make to play on a period instrument?
Well, it's just a totally different instrument.
An oboe is difficult to play no matter whether it's old or new, isn't
well,
it?
that's a famous line, of course. But I think all instruments are equally difficult or easy to play on a certain level. In a sense, if I was going to start a student on an oboe, I would start them on an old oboe. The old oboe is, in a sense, easier to play. It takes less wind pressure, it's in terms of its the amount of strength that's required to play it, there's less strength involved. So if you were just coming out of the blue, I don't think that oboe would be any more difficult than the modern oboe. Obviously, if I was at music conservatory and I'd played the modern oboe all my life, when I first started to play the Baroque oboe, sure, it was more difficult than that instrument was.
Now, Tom, as somebody who conducts the orchestra, can you spot a modern oboe sound immediately?
Before he even plays. Oh, it's to me, it's so obvious, and you know, I mean, that's my primary motivation. I mean, Mark and his colleagues are the first generation, as he said, of people who learned these techniques here in New York City. Now, finally, we have universities, even the Juilliard School, only recently added a historic performance facility. But I think for myself as a conductor and the players in the orchestra, it's simply more satisfying to approach this instrument, approach this literature, using the tools that the composers had.
Are all the instruments different?
Yes.
Every instrument in the orchestra?
Every single instrument.
You brought some your oboes with you. Do you carry them around with you? Or did you bring them because you were coming to the show?
I brought them because there was some either misunderstanding or some idea that perhaps I was going to take them out and
you could do
play
that.
Them. If you'd like, you could. I'll do that.
And in the meantime,
take a few seconds. Just a second.
I mean, I think you know. People often ask me also is it because of the historic aspect of it? You know, there are lots of people interested in history alone, and my answer is a firm no. I'm not interested in reenactments. We don't play with powdered wigs. We don't. You know, it's because of the literature. It's like people who build globe theaters nowadays. You know, it's because we have the Shakespeare plays.
But also, it would seem to me, we would want to know what the composer had in mind, and the only way we could really know that is to hear it played on the instruments that he composed for.
Well, that's what I think. But, of course, you have to have a level of playing quality, too, and that certainly hurt the movement in the early years. People got out these squeaky instruments and thought, gee, that doesn't sound as nice as my modern evolved instrument, you know. But now that's changed. I mean, top players like Mark.
And Mark, when did you start playing with the American Classical Orchestra?
Well, when I started playing with the American Classical Orchestra, it wasn't called the American Classical Orchestra. It was called even before Old Fairfield, it was still the Fairfield Chamber Orchestra. But then very quickly it became the Orchestra of the Old Fairfield Academy, I believe was its name. And that's when Tom's venture became exclusively original instruments. And we made a bunch of recordings. In fact, I made a quick aside to Tom when we came in and we heard the Mozart Oboe Concerto being played as the intro to this. I said, gee, at least they could have played our recording of it because we recorded all the Mozart concerti. And I could immediately ask them whether you can recognize the modern oboe as opposed to the period oboe. Of course, I could recognize my own playing, but I could certainly recognize that difference. Anyway, so what I have here in front of you, it's too bad we're not on TV, but it's a replica of an oboe d'amore, and the oboe, of course, came in different sizes in
oboe d'amore,
in the 18th
century. Oboe of love?
The oboe of love. It is the oboe that in the Magnificat, which we are playing on Tuesday night here at Alice Tully Hall, has a wonderful, beautiful, haunting aria for the Queer Expects It for oboe and soprano. And even though you can't see it, I guess you can hear it. And without warming up, here is basically what it sounds like.
So you can probably tell it has a darker sound, you know, than a modern, a brighter oboe.
Now, can you tell us about Bach's Magnificat? It isn't performed as much as his St. Matthew's Passion, and yet this is a great piece of music.
Yeah, you know, musicians just adore it. It's fascinating how, of all the great Bach works, people say that they really look forward to playing this piece. And when I look at it compared to cantatas or the St. Matthew or whatever, I think, you know, what thrills me about it is that each movement comes along and you think, oh, this is my favorite one. I mean, it's one gem after another.
And it really does incorporate the chorus, the choir, whatever, with the orchestra in a way that we think of more of like almost Beethovenian in that it just is such a perfect mix.
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, you know, in Bach's life, the choir had such a huge role, and they have each of the five choral parts has its own significance as part of the counterpoint. In other words, they sing the instruments, sometimes play with them, sometimes don't.
And the two choirs, Trinity Church Princeton, Trinity Church New Haven, they're obviously not singing on old instruments, period instruments.
As a matter of fact,
but would
ten,
the choir, yeah. would the they sound different than they would if they were doing this with the New York Philharmonic?
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, Leonard, because it happens in my experience as a musician that of all the textures, all the blends, the sound of highly trained children's voices with period instruments is the end of the line. It's just the most wonderful thing. So these are some 10-year-old children. They're highly trained in the tradition of training treble voices, and the blend is exquisite.
Now you're doing Handel's organ concerto, and Alice Tully Hall has the only remaining pipe organ in a major New York concert hall. But is it something that Handel would have recognized, the sound of it?
Or oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a tracker organ. It's very much voiced in the way that the organs were in Handel's time. Absolutely. He wouldn't have heard one in a concert hall.
Mm-hmm. Mark, the program also includes a rarely heard work by Boyce, his symphony in B-flat. Boyce isn't exactly a household name.
No.
Can you tell us
no,
a bit about him?
He was an English composer that, of course, was far less famous than Handel, but had a very successful career, slightly later than Handel, and wrote a bunch of symphonies. And I can tell you, I'm not even sure which one we're doing, but I've played many of them before, and when we get to the rehearsal, we'll find out.
Is it a good fit with the Magnificat?
Oh, well, it's a light overture-like piece. You know, it's a perfect 10-minute introduction. The Magnificat's only 30 minutes long.
Yeah. You're giving a lecture before the concert at 7 p.m. What will you be telling that audience?
Actually, I'm going to the lecture is in the auditorium, so I'm going to go over and play some of the organ and talk to them about the tracker action organ. You know, people don't get to see a first-class organ like that anymore in a concert hall, as you just mentioned. So I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the individual jewels in the Magnificat primarily.
Yeah, Mark, you've recorded with the American Classical Orchestra a CD of Venetian oboe concerti with works by Vivaldi, Albinoni, Macello, and Handel. Can Handel be identified as a Venetian composer?
Not a Venetian composer, but if you read the liner notes that I wrote for that, first of all, I included the Handel because I really wanted to, and we weren't sure when we made the program exactly what it would be called. But as I was doing research for the liner notes, Handel had his greatest successes as a young man. Of course, he left Germany and went to Italy to study. And it was in Venice that he wrote his first really great opera, Agrippina, which has an extremely florid oboe part. And it's not typical in Handel's operas that he writes so extensively for the oboe. And the oboe concerto doesn't have the G minor concerto that we recorded there. It doesn't have a specific composition date or location. So it's extremely likely that he could have written it there.
Now, the oboe is a double reed instrument. You put the reed into your mouth. Is that
right,
the only instrument? Is that the only instrument that where you do that?
No. The bassoon.
Oh, the
bassoon is another double reed instrument. And, of course, the ancestors of the oboe and bassoon, the shawm and the dulcian, those instruments also had this double reed, yeah.
And we see it in India with the shanai.
Exactly.
Could you pick up a shanai and play it?
I could make a noise on it, but I don't think I could play it.
Now, Tom, there's been a rather difficult time for orchestras. Even great ones like the Philadelphia and Cleveland have been foundering, going through bankruptcy. What is your thoughts about what you have to do to keep an orchestra going?
Well, play very well.
They play very well.
Maybe I shouldn't say it, but it may even have something to do with entitlements. You know, the American Classical Orchestra is a freelance orchestra, as was Mozart's orchestra, as have they been through the ages. It wasn't until the 20th century that we came up with these conglomerates of musicians with contracts and cradle-to-grave guarantees. You know, against sliding ticket sales and a lot of entertainment competition and so forth. So we come up with what we think are creative programs that will catch the public attention, and we're doing very well.
I look forward to hearing the Magnificat. It's going to be 8 p.m., Lincoln Center's Alice Tully Hall, coming up on November 27th, a week from today, right?
Yes, sir.
And thank you both so much for being on our show. Thomas Crawford, founding music director and conductor of the American Classical Orchestra, and Mark Shackman, oboist with the American Classical Orchestra and other places. Thank you both.
Thank you.